It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
Which is absolutely crazy. Hello, hello, my pretties. It's your host, Ashley Lana, your certified nightmare prescriber, welcoming you back to another episode of The Fear Cult. How are y'all doing this week? I can't express how insane this case is tonight, and I want you guys to monitor every time you think or say out loud how insane this bitch is. She is crazy, and I'm very excited to tell you about it. I'm looking at the case photos right now, and it doesn't get better the more you look at it. So, with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Last week, we discussed the very strange Carl Tanzler who kept a woman in his house for 7 years encased in wax and plaster of Paris. Tonight, we're going to be going to Australia. I love Australia, so this is exciting, and all my Australian listeners are really pumped because they've wanted me to do this case for a bit. Yeah, I hear you, Australia. I hear you reaching out to me. So I'm going to do this one specifically for you guys. So if any of my other listeners have not eaten, then perfect. You're well suited for this case. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of mental illness, physical abuse, cannibalism, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. This was it. The day Catherine had dreamed of. She was going to get married. Being a woman who enjoyed to stand out in the crowd, she and her fiancé hopped onto a motorcycle in their best clothes. Together, they drove to the local registry's office and signed their marriage papers. Once it was official, they were then off to meet their friends at a popular bar in town. Upon arriving, people smiled and shook their heads. Typical Catherine, always making an entrance. But today was her day, so she could do whatever she wanted. After a few hours, Catherine sauntered up to her husband and immediately recognized that he was heavily intoxicated. She held back her annoyance and proceeded to act as if it was the happiest moment in her life, despite his odd behavior. That night, the newlyweds did as most couples do. They engaged in passionate sex. 3 times, to be exact. And once her husband settled down, he soon fell asleep. As Catherine moved closer to the man, she heard him begin to snore. Sitting up, she straddled his body and gazed down at her husband. She ran her hands up his chest and brought them to his neck, and then she began choking him. Her grip only contracted harder around his throat as he began to thrash about. Catherine was not being playful. She was about to murder her husband. This is the true story of Catherine Knight, the Hannibal Lecter of Australia, the Butcher of Aberdeen. Catherine Mary Knight was born October 24, 1955, in Tenerfield, New South Wales, Australia. She was the youngest fraternal twin daughter of Barbara Ruffin and Ken Knight. The family had a complicated relationship. Before Barbara met Ken, she was married to Jack Ruffin, and together they had 4 sons. While in this marriage, Barbara began an adulterous relationship with her co-worker, Ken Knight. When the locals heard of this scandalous affair, Barbara decided to leave her husband and her 4 sons to pursue this new relationship. In 1952, Barbara and Ken married and proceeded to start their own family together. Ken already had 2 sons from a previous relationship, and Barbara and Ken had 4 children together, 2 older boys and 2 twin girls, Catherine Mary Knight being the youngest. Growing up, Catherine did not have a healthy home life. Her father, Ken, was an aggressive alcoholic who did physically beat his wife and kids. When his family tried to stand up for themselves, he would only intimidate and gaslight everyone. Ken and Barbara would constantly argue, and he would rape her up to 10 times a day, as the family explained. Ken Knight dropped out of school at the age of 14 and began working at the slaughterhouse in Aberdeen, New South Wales. He was considered a very hard worker who was passionate about his career. Barbara Knight was a strict, impetuous, and temperamental woman. Her attitude was inherited by her children, especially Catherine. As Catherine was growing up, she was a loner. She had no problem standing up for herself. And although a majority of her time was starting fights, her classmates at Musselwell Brook High School recalled her as the school bully. They remembered her belittling the younger students and pushing them into lockers. There was one incident where Catherine physically assaulted a teacher, claiming self-defense, and another case where she assaulted another student with a deadly weapon. She was always getting into arguments with classmates, particularly the boys who would pick on her for her red hair and glasses. And she learned from her father, you always hit back at someone who disrespects you. Although her father was abusive, Catherine seemed to have a high respect and love for Ken. When Catherine was 15 years old, before she learned how to read and write, she dropped out of school to follow in her father's footsteps and work at the slaughterhouse. Her application was accepted the second time, and she started with grunt work, mopping up pools of blood on the floor and disposing of the animal pelts and organs. She, like her father, was a hard worker, and soon she was promoted to a slicer. Catherine was now in charge of trimming and cutting the slaughtered animal carcasses. She adored this job. She loved being able to discover new techniques to remove the excess fat from the meat and skinning the limbs. This promotion came with a new addition to her arsenal, a brand new set of butcher knives. These knives she cherished, and she even hung them over her bed at night in case she needed them. Her childhood dream was to become the best employee at the abattoir. So Catherine's relationship with her father is interesting. It's not good, but it's kind of interesting because she doesn't particularly hate him. So he would physically and psychologically abuse his family violently when he was drunk, and he would rape their mother, Barbara. Barbara was also not hiding these facts from her children, and her children were very young. So sex was openly discussed in the home, but not in a positive, healthy way. It was almost always negative and aggressive. And Catherine, she expressed that her father never raped her, but other family members did. A study was conducted in 2014, and the journal article is titled Parental Psychological Abuse Towards Children and Mental Health Problems in Adolescence. So research shows that children who have experienced parental psychological abuse exhibit common mental health problems. This form of abuse can be extremely destructive, and studies show that parental abuse has been associated with a wide range of adverse childhood effects, and examples of this include depression, social anxiety, poor self-esteem, conduct problems, aggression, and the inability to trust and underachievement. Catherine is a very complex creature, and we are not psychologists. We are simply just trying to understand the dark psychology behind what goes on inside of her mind. So let's explore this one. She inherited her mother's hot temper and was raised in an abusive household. Because of all the years of abuse, it definitely had an effect on her mental health, and Catherine was very explosive and physically violent. She was explosive like her mother and violent like her father. We can see how she mirrored her parents and how she would have to prove her worth to others as she was trying to be tough, which shows how she may have painted a tough and confident demeanor in the public, but internally she was probably compensating for her poor self-esteem. As I continue with the case, we will see how her self-esteem and inability to trust make her an absolute fucking nightmare of a human being. She has a conduct disorder like nobody's business. So, conduct disorder is diagnosed when an individual shows an ongoing pattern of aggression towards other people that violate rules and social norms in public or in the home. So Catherine wasn't particularly close with her father, but looked up to him. And then in later interviews, Catherine explains that she was really close with her uncle, Oscar. And in 1969, he committed suicide. And to this day, Catherine maintains the idea that his ghost still visits her. Psychologically, this isn't strange in her case at all, since she was only ever close with two people, her twin sister and her uncle. So losing him and thinking she was seeing him was simply just a coping mechanism for her and a sense of a protective male presence, because although she looked up to her father, she definitely didn't feel a sense of protection because he was so violent, he did hurt her. The case will take a twist, And as I was reviewing the case of Catherine Knight, I would always stop and say, this fucking woman. She is an Ashley Lana certified fruitcake. She's fucking nuts. So let's continue. Despite her aggressive behavior when she was in school, Catherine was generally known for being kind-hearted and sweet, just not to be messed with. Catherine would help her mother around the house and enjoyed cooking. During those times, her mother Barbara would confide in her about her hatred for sex. This hate stemmed from the sexual abuse she was forcefully receiving from Ken. Catherine also revealed that she was sexually abused by her family, although not by her father. When Catherine was a bit older, she recalls telling her mother about how men just wanted to do perverse sex acts with her, and that she was not comfortable with it. Barbara, however, just responded with, "Put up with it and stop complaining." In 1973, when Catherine was 18 years old, she met David Stanford Kellett, who was a co-worker at the slaughterhouse. It did not take long for Catherine to assert her dominance in the relationship. She manipulated him to control almost every aspect of his life. The couple would commonly get into physical fights that Catherine would instigate, and let it be known that her strength was very deceiving for her small stature. And since David was an alcoholic, much like her father, whenever he got into drunken fights at the bar, Catherine would be the first to confidently step in and break it up. It didn't matter how big or tough the other person was. She always resorted to physical violence. The town of Aberdeen soon grew to know the threatening reputation of the fiery redhead, Catherine Mary Knight. In 1974, Catherine insisted that she and David get married. The couple arrived to the reception on a motorcycle, and David was already heavily intoxicated. Very soon after arriving, Catherine's mother, Barbara, quietly pulled David off to the side. David Keller recalled the conversation he had with Catherine's mother. Quote, "The old girl, Barbara, said to me to watch out. You better watch this one or she'll fucking kill you. Stir her up the wrong way or do the wrong thing and you're fucked. Don't you ever think of playing up on her, cheating on her. She'll fucking kill you." And that was her mother talking. She told me she's got something loose. She's got a screw loose somewhere. It was later that night after the party when Catherine attempted to strangle David. Catherine explained that she was so angry that he fell asleep after only having intercourse three times that night. The marriage of Catherine and David experienced both warm and cherished moments. However, they were often clouded by frequent violent incidents. One event that occurred was while Catherine was pregnant and near the end of her pregnancy. David came home late from a dart competition. He was proud to have made it to the finals. To Catherine, this was no excuse, and it sent her into a murderous rampage. She stormed into their bedroom and grabbed all of his clothes, taking them to the backyard. She proceeded to light them all on fire, and then she stomped back into the house and went into the kitchen. Catherine grabbed a cast iron frying pan and severely fractured David's skull with one blow. David rushed out of the house and collapsed at a neighbor's house. When the police arrived, Catherine did what she did best, manipulated her way out of the situation. She explained their argument and that it was nothing, and was able to convince David to drop the charges against her. In May of 1976, Catherine gave birth to their first and only daughter, Melissa Ann Knight. Her husband David was sick of her manipulating and violent behavior. He felt that his life would be in danger if he suggested that they separate. So, he did what many probably would have. He ran. David moved to Queensland, Australia to be with another woman who was also pregnant with his child, telling no one. Soon after, witnesses seen Catherine pushing her stroller down the street, thrashing it about with her child inside, crying. Catherine was then admitted into St. Elmo's Hospital, where she was diagnosed with postnatal depression. After being released, she took two-month-old Melissa Ann down to the railroad tracks. She glanced at the time, and according to the train schedule, the next tram should be coming by very soon. Catherine then placed the baby on the tracks and left. On her way back into town, she grabbed an axe and proceeded to threaten everyone she'd seen that she was going to kill them. Catherine was then arrested for the second time and was taken back to the hospital. Earlier that day, a man was walking down by the tracks when he seen a blanket on the railroad tracks. As he approached the fabric, he seen two-month-old Melissa Ann, safe and unharmed. Witnesses explained that after he picked up the baby, a train went by only minutes after. The very next day, Catherine was released from the hospital. She then went back to her house and grabbed her knife set from her bedroom, and she went on the hunt. While in town, she threatened a woman with her boning knife, forcing her to drive her to Queensland, Australia, to find David. When the woman refused, Catherine slashed her across the face, and then the woman agreed. The two drove in silence for miles. Then they had to make a pit stop to get gas. The woman used this time to make an escape and drove away, leaving Catherine behind. When the police arrived, Catherine had taken a small boy hostage at knife point. The police were able to disarm and restrain Catherine. She was then admitted into Morissette Psychiatric Hospital. When the nurses questioned Catherine on her behavior, she explained that she had planned to murder the mechanic at the gas station because he had repaired David Kellett's car, which apparently allowed him to leave her and her child. She continued to reveal that her plan was to locate David and kill him, and then track down his mother and murder her too. The police contacted David and informed him of what Catherine had admitted to the nurses. Now, it is unknown specifically why David decided to move back with Catherine, but he did. David and his mother moved to Aberdeen, and Catherine was released on August 9th, 1976. The common theories explain that David was either terrified that once Catherine was released from the hospital, she would continue to hunt him and his mother down and murder them, or he felt pity for her and still had feelings for her. Either way, David and his mother moved back with Catherine to Woodbridge, which is a suburb of Brisbane, Australia. Catherine began working at another meat plant in the area. 4 years later, David and Catherine had another child. On March 6th, in 1980, their new daughter, Natasha Marie, brought new hope into starting a new life together. The couple then moved back to Aberdeen, and Catherine went back to working at the original slaughterhouse. She then hurt her back and was able to claim a disability pension. David and Catherine decided that now was the time to part ways, and she was now able to support her kids on her own. Now that she no longer needed to work, the government gave her and her two daughters public housing. In 1986, Catherine met 38-year-old David Saunders. The two made a fast connection and moved in together soon after. David had kept his previous apartment in Scone, so he had some freedom, which Catherine did not like. The two would fight over how jealous she was. She was trying to control everything he did, and because he demanded his own free time, she accused him of cheating on her. The routine involved her throwing him out, then telling him that he didn't need her, then crawling back to his apartment and begging him to take her back. I decided to delve into the psychology of why victims go back to their abusers and even sometimes defend them in cases, all right? So the CDC statistics show that 1 in 4 women and 1 in 9 men are victims of physical, mental, and/or sexual violence or stalking. According to Dr. Ellen Hendrickson, there are 4 reasons why victims go back to their abusers. Number 1 is unequal power. So this is number 1 for a reason. An abusive relationship is overall about gaining power over the partner and breaking their self-worth and significance to control them. So this involves one partner controlling the finances, decision-making, and whom they're allowed to be friends with. And this allows abusers to ensure that leaving is not an option. Number 2 is manipulation. Abusers are intelligent and often charismatic, and they will gaslight the victim, making them feel as if the abuse is their fault and it's not bad, and they gaslight them, making them feel that they deserve it. This makes the victim feel as though they're the crazy ones, which makes leaving much more difficult for them. Number 3 is hope. The hope that eventually everything will change and the abuse will stop. There is a common concept in abusive relationships that psychiatrists explain. In some circumstances, victims feel as though they are the only ones who can calm their abusers down, and this gives the false illusion of control to the victim, making them feel that the abuse might stop one day. And one of the most dangerous, love. When love is paired with hope, it's a terrible combination because together they make the abuse feel as though it's just a rough patch. And like Catherine's exes, they all ran back to her after some event. And it's very common to get sucked back into the abuse if you love someone at one point when they were good. The combination of those 4 are the reasons why people stay or go back to an abusive relationship. It's different for everyone, but psychiatrists have figured out that those are the 4 main common reasons. Catherine Knight is the perfect example of a toxic, abusive partner. She is a power control seeker. She is a master manipulator, which we will see as I continue. And she manipulates a situation in order to pass the blame for her actions. And she's a bit of a superficial charmer. Otherwise, how else would she be able to get away with her past actions? I have to say it because I haven't said it in a while. She's a fucking nightmare. Catherine has this ability to play the victim after she has had an outburst. And there are people who thought that she was the kindest and most tough woman that you would have ever have met. And there are those who see the side of her that we are looking into, that she is batshit fucking crazy. And this ability to grasp other people's emotions, to manipulate and charm them, is very dangerous. And I hate to say his name, but Ted Bundy is a perfect example of this. Catherine is also a blue-collar working woman, or she was until she got injured. But she seemed like an average Joe to everyone else, and others just seen her as kind but very weird. So those four traits that I just mentioned, power controlling, manipulation, superficial charmer, and the average Joe effect, are four of the five key traits that criminologists use to spot a serial killer. Catherine did not seem to have like the third trait, which is an egotistical bragger, because there's no evidence that she ever bragged about the atrocities that she will do later on. And this woman, she just keeps getting crazier. Let's move on. In May of 1987, Catherine slit the throat of David Saunders' 2-month-old puppy right in front of him, just to threaten him with what she would do if he ever cheated on her. David was then left in utter shock. Catherine then retrieved a cast iron frying pan and knocked him unconscious. No matter the drama between Catherine and David, they continued their relationship. In June the following year, she gave birth to her third daughter, Sarah. Now that David Saunders realized that he was legally required to support their child, he decided to put a deposit on a home for the growing family. Catherine began decorating the house full of macabre art, such as taxidermied animals, assorted weapons, skulls, and animal horns. There was no space left undecorated. One day, Catherine and David had gotten into a heated argument, which resulted in him getting smashed in the face with a hot iron. Catherine finished her point by stabbing him in the stomach with a pair of scissors. As usual, David immediately left to go back to his apartment. Later, once things had cooled down, he returned to their home and found that she had destroyed all of his clothing by cutting them into pieces. David decided that he needed to take time away from their relationship to think things through, and he went into hiding. In this time frame, Catherine began panicking. Another man had run away from her antics. Catherine began searching and questioning everyone about the whereabouts of David Saunders. Everyone was staying silent. Not knowing what to do, Catherine did the only thing she knew how to do: play the victim and get the upper hand. Months went by with no word from David. When he returned to see his daughter, he was met by the police. Weeks earlier, Catherine had gone to the police and wept, putting on a dramatic show. She told them that she was terrified of David and what he might do to her and her daughter when he returned, and she did not know what she had done to deserve it. The police issued her an apprehended violence order against David, never seeing Catherine or his daughter again. In 1990, Catherine had begun a sexual relationship with 43-year-old former co-worker named John Chillingworth. John was a friendly father of three from a failed marriage. A year later, Catherine gave birth to her fifth child, a boy named Eric. Their relationship lasted for 3 years, and she left John for a man she was secretly having an affair with, John Price. John Price was a friendly father of three who worked at a local mine. He had many friends and was well-liked by everyone, including the police. The kindness of John was known to all, and he believed in the kindness of others, which was his downfall. He knew of Catherine's temperament before he decided to start a relationship with her. And in 1995, when Catherine was around 40 years old, she moved in with his kids. His children recalled liking Catherine at the start, and they all spent happy times together. Following pattern, over time, Catherine had begun instigating arguments with John. In 1998, she had begun pestering John to marry her, and he rejected her every time. This, of course, sent Catherine into a rage. She retaliated by stealing a large sum of his money to purchase herself an engagement ring. Of course, John seen this and emphasized that he was not ready to marry her, especially after doing this. That's when Catherine felt herself losing control of the relationship. She was no longer in power, and Catherine did what Catherine did best. Catherine Knight decided she was going to ruin his entire career. The local mine where John had worked for 17 years, the staff had been throwing out the expired first aid kits in the trash. John had begun taking them from the garbage to keep his supply at home. Catherine manipulated the situation and recorded a video of the surplus of kits at the home, claiming that John had been stealing them. She then sent the tape directly to John's boss, and he was immediately fired. John was infuriated with Catherine. He kicked her out of his home, and the news spread of what Catherine had done. Months had passed, and for some bewildering reason, John restarted his relationship with Catherine. This time, he did not let her move back into his house with his kids. Their relationship grew more violent and abusive. It got so bad that John's friends questioned why they even stayed together. At this point, many of John's friends were hesitant to even associate with him, and that he had chosen a life with Catherine Knight. It was in February 2000 when Catherine began a series of physical assaults on John. One resulted in John getting brutally stabbed in the chest. Again, John had kicked her out. And on February 29th, 2000, John Price told his boss that he wanted to go to the Scone Magistrate Court to file a restraining order against Catherine. John explained to the magistrate that the previous night he was woken up by the feeling of someone watching him. When he looked over, he seen Catherine's silhouette standing at the foot of the bed, with her arms behind her back. He leapt out of bed, absolutely terrified, thinking that she had a knife. As he moved closer, he was about to make a run for it, and then he seen in the mirror that there was nothing behind her back, just her hands. She smirked at him and left the room. This was not the first time that Catherine had performed such an act. He received unfortunate news that he was told that he was going to have to wait 3 weeks before he could go to court. It was later, back at work, when John was chatting with his coworkers and showed them two stab wounds that he had received from Catherine. His coworkers pleaded with him not to go back home that night, and John said that he had to go because if he did not, she was going to go after his children. He'd rather be murdered than have her hurt his kids. John told his coworkers, quote, "If I do not come back into work tomorrow, it's because she killed me. When you drive by my house in the morning, if my truck is still in the driveway, call the police." While John was at work, Catherine had purchased black lingerie. She then recorded a videotape of her and her children. In the video, she is seen hugging and kissing her kids, while making statements that could be perceived as a last will and testament. Later that night, around 11 p.m., Catherine decided that she needed to see John and work things out. She arrived at his home, and she relaxed by watching television. After, she had a shower to freshen up, and then crawled into bed next to John. The two proceeded to have sex. The next day, Officer Scott Matthews of the New South Wales Police Department had received a call from John Price's coworker, who had drove by his house and seen that his truck was still parked in the driveway. The responding sergeant initially thought that John probably slept in. Officers Scott Matthews and Graham Furlonger responded to the Aberdeen residence to investigate. The officers knocked on the door. There was no answer. There was blood on the door, which caught their attention. As they cautiously inspected the door, they peeked through the mail slot and seen a dark lounge area. In the room, the police described what looked like to be a bunched-up curtain. The officers decided to break in through the back door. The house was completely dark and full of shadows. Officer Furlong details how he saw the object that he thought was a curtain hanging from the archway of the hallway. Officer Matthews then used his left arm to push the curtain, and he felt coldness. He retracted his arm and seen that it was covered in blood. Both officers stepped back and soon realized that this moment was never going to fade from their memories. The curtain hanging from the archway was the full human pelt of 45-year-old John Price. Catherine had removed his entire body from its skin and hung it above the hallway. The entire full-skin suit without a head. The officers looked past the skin to see a skinned torso laying on the ground without a head or genitalia. Where his head should have been was only a pool of soaked blood. His body had been stabbed 37 times. Catherine positioned the body with John's left arm draped over a bottle of soda, with his legs crossed. During the trial, it was explained the reasoning for this was to demonstrate the defilement of his body, with Catherine's contempt. Catherine had left a note on top of a photograph of John, covered in bits of flesh. It read, quote, "Time you got back, Jonathan, for raping my daughter. You and Beck," Jonathan's daughter Rebecca, "for Ross, for little John. Now, play with little John's dick, John Price." The accusations on the note were proven groundless. Drawing their guns, the officers slowly entered the rest of the house. Blood was painted all over the walls and the furniture as if a paint can exploded. They entered the kitchen and seen a pot on the stovetop. Officer Furlong recalled turning to Officer Matthews and saying, quote, "I'll give you one guess where the head is." The police observed the kitchen. On the table were a couple plates that had parts of cooked buttocks, garnished with vegetables, baked potatoes, and gravy. Catherine had boiled John's head in a pot with vegetables. The pot was still warm. Each plate had a handwritten note to each of John's two children. The two notes stated that if she could not have their father, then no one else can. Catherine had intended to feed John's children his body. The officers investigated the rest of the house and found 49-year-old Catherine Knight asleep in the bedroom. Officer Furlonger attempted to wake Catherine, who appeared to have attempted to commit suicide by taking pills. She had no injuries, and the police carried her body out into the backyard and called the ambulance. No one else was in the house. When the ambulance arrived, many of the locals had gathered around the front lawn to witness the events. A friend of John Price's daughter, Rosemary, recalls her good friend being at the house when Catherine got escorted out of the house by the paramedics. A good friend of mine said she was there the morning they brought her out of the house. She said, "Rosie, I don't care what anyone says, she walked out of that house as sane as you and I." She said the only one she looked at was my brother, and she said that she had a grin on her face, and my brother just dropped to his knees. The news of a woman murdering a man in Aberdeen got around quick. Catherine's ex-husband, David Kellett's sister, Sandy, said in an interview, quote, "It came over the radio that a lady from Aberdeen had killed her husband, and I just looked over at my husband and I said, you know, that would have had to have been my sister-in-law. It couldn't be anyone else. It would have to be Kathy." Sandy explains how when the confirmation came over the news later that day that it was indeed Catherine Knight, it came as no surprise to her. Police had the difficult task of informing John's family of the devastating news. They spoke to his son, Jonathan. However, they didn't know how to tell 14-year-old Rebecca. Rebecca Price found out that her father had been brutally skinned and decapitated in a newspaper. She asked her mother if the news was true, and her mother just shook her head and said yes. Rebecca spent the next 3 hours laying on the floor crying and couldn't move. Many of the investigators who responded to the crime scene have been in treatment in attempts to forget about what they seen inside the home of John Price. Over the next 6 days, Catherine Knight was admitted into hospital. When she woke, she claimed to have zero recollection of anything that had happened that night. She did recall stabbing him 6 months earlier. She claimed that she was holding the knife and she pointed it at him and he leaned back and it just stabbed him, blaming her lack of vision due to wearing new glasses. Catherine was put into psychiatric tests, which concluded that she was not suffering from any psychotic breaks. Further evidence proved that she was sane came from John Price's solicitor, who discovered that $1,000 was taken from John's account the night he was killed. This fucking woman, oh my God. You guys, I can't stand this woman. She is on another level, and give me a minute. Okay. Psychiatric tests confirmed that Catherine was sane, and she knew exactly what she was doing. So 3 psychiatrists diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder, And it's important to note that BPD is not a psychiatric illness, and not everyone with BPD will commit horrific crimes. Okay, we clear? We all good? Crystal? Murky? Let's go. So the National Institute of Mental Health describes borderline personality disorder as an illness marked by an ongoing pattern of varying moods, self-image, and impulsive behavior. These symptoms often result in impulsive actions and problems in relationships. For example, Catherine would imagine if someone had tried to harm her in any way, real or not, she would retaliate by ruining their life before anything could even happen. And borderline personality disorder can be caused by a number of things, including bullying, neglect, sexual and/or physical abuse, and even emotional abuse. Biological genetics and traumatic childhoods could also increase the risk of being diagnosed. The study concluded, quote, "According to the measures in the study, BPD is moderately to strongly associated with a range of criminal behaviors among psychiatric inpatients, likely owing these individuals extreme proclivity towards disinhibition and poor emotional regulations," unquote. While it may be true that there is a high percentage of BPD and other mental health disorders in the prison population, only 3-5% of violent acts can be attributed to people with a serious mental illness. In fact, people with mental illness are actually far more likely to be victims of violent crime compared to the rest of the population. It might explain Catherine Knight's violent behavior, but it is very rare that BPD causes someone to commit such horrific crimes, and it's definitely not the main reason why she committed these crimes. During the initial trial, Catherine pled not guilty to manslaughter. Her trial was set for July 23, 2001, but was adjourned until October 15, 2001, due to her counsel's illness. On the 15th, Catherine talked to her attorneys, and they spoke to the judge, who allowed the trial to be adjourned until the next day. The next morning, to the surprise of everyone, Catherine decided to change her plea to guilty, and yet still refused to accept responsibility of her actions. Justice O'Keefe recognized something was suspicious. He explained that he became worried that if he accepted her guilty sentence, then she would appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeal and plead insanity and disassociation at the time she made the guilty plea. Justice Barry O'Keefe decided that a court expert should examine Catherine. Then he adjourned the case again. He ordered a psychiatric evaluation. The doctors confirmed that Catherine was, quote, sane and a very bad woman. During the trial, Catherine's brother testified against her, confirming Catherine had premeditated the crime 3 weeks prior to killing John Price. She had told him that she was going to plea insanity and that she was going to get away with murder. She sat the entire trial with not a sign of emotion on her face and never looked at anyone or any evidence, just an impassive shell. The only time Catherine showed emotion was when the court played the police crime scene footage. Catherine started rocking violently and screaming in the courtroom. When Catherine wanted an adjournment, she manipulated her behavior. She showed no remorse and did not take responsibility for her actions, which substantially increased the probability that she would commit the crimes again if she was set free. On October 18, 2001, Catherine Mary Knight pled guilty to the first-degree murder of John Price. Catherine was given the harshest sentence possible in Australian law. She is the first woman to ever be sentenced to life in prison without parole, and written on her criminal file is, quote, never to be released. That was the true story of Catherine Knight. Isn't she crazy? She is insane. Stories of relationship abuse with a male partner being the victim are more common than a lot of people realize. And there are some who believe abusive relationships are just physical. Absolutely not. Emotional and psychological abuse are also included. And Catherine would manipulate and control her partners and get physical when they stood up for themselves with any violence. So she seen violence as a way of control, and she watched her father do it to her family, and she carried it out through her entire life, which resulted in the death of an innocent man. So it's very important that if you take anything away from this case, it's if you are going through anything like this, seek help from friends or authorities, just don't ever feel like you were alone. Never stop trying, because relationship abuse is very common and it's something that needs to have awareness brought to it. So please never feel like you were alone. Go call your local authorities if you feel that you're in danger, and make sure that it's an open concept you have with people. It shouldn't be not talked about. Now, Catherine, old Catherine, she is currently locked up in Silverwater Correctional Facility, where she is considered to be, quote, the boss in the prison. And she never lets anyone push her around. She breaks up fights, and she also has a clean record in prison. Surprise, surprise. A former penthouse pet named Victoria Shembri, I probably butchered that last name, please forgive me. Now, she became friends with Catherine Knight while in prison, and she said that even though Catherine committed those horrific crimes, she is one of the nicest and kindest people she has ever met. And she explains how she is diligent and hardworking and enjoys her job, which is making airplane headphones. Now, with all due condescending respect, Victoria, those traits she had from a very young age. And those traits got her promoted in her career, so it's not exactly frontline news. Her friendliness got her out of many possible assault charges from her ex, and they kept coming back because of her charm. While being a hardworking, friendly woman to the world, she still skinned her fucking self-proclaimed husband and tried to feed his body to his young children. And to this day, she does not regret it. Oh yes, Catherine Knight is a true national hero, Victoria. My God. I can't, and I don't forgive serial killers, and I never will. I'm not glorifying them. I think they're all fucking monsters. And if I went to prison, I hope not, I get eaten alive. If I went to prison and then a serial killer, well, Catherine wasn't a serial killer, she only killed one person, but she attempted to kill her child, let's not forget. If I went in and someone who had committed those crimes was to talk to me and they were to talk friendly to me, I would almost be more worried than if they were complete jackasses, but that's just me. What do you guys think? Would you be worried? Kindness from a cruel heart is very suspicious. Also, if I went to prison for the rest of my life, I wouldn't make it a living hell for myself. And getting on the guards' hate list? Oh, hell no. Of course Catherine's gonna be nice. Because knowing her, she's an opportunist, and she will try to appeal for the rest of her fucking life. Even if there's no chance. Why the hell not? She has nothing better to do anyways. But let's be nice people. Let's just not murder our husbands. Fantastic.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
The never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie. This movie was recommended to me from the slasher community. And these fear cult members are on another level of horror movie fanatics, which is why I integrated Lullaby into the slasher community. I made a post saying the horror movies I've seen, which disturbed me. And as sadistic as this is, not very many do. So I posted that I watched Cannibal Holocaust, and for the love of God, a Serbian film. Don't ever watch a Serbian film. It is fucking... Yeesh. All right. I feel like it's illegal to talk about it. That movie is harsh. So, as I've said before, I'm very picky with horror movies and I don't get scared easily. I posted that I wanted to be more disturbed than those two movies I just mentioned. And the slasher fear cult, you did not let me down. You, my God. I have 6 international horror gore movies that I've added to my list and I am so excited to watch them. One that I watched was the 2009 exploitation horror film Grotesque, and I was left thinking, oh my God, I can't recommend this. I can't recommend this for the shock value alone, so I'm not particularly recommending it. I'm just letting you guys know that it exists, that is all. The film was banned in a lot of countries due to the intensity of it. And the plot involves a doctor who kidnaps and tortures a couple in a game of torment that slowly erodes their hopes of survival. So if Saw and the Hostel movies bothered you in any way, don't even attempt to Google grotesque. It's a shock film. Like, it's meant to make you extremely uncomfortable. And although it didn't scare me, it made me look away from my TV like I was Jim from The Office, like someone was watching me watch it, and I was very uncomfortable. But of course I continued watching it. And I have 5 more on that list that I gotta watch, so I'll keep you guys posted. The YouTube horror short this week is the 2022 suspense-filled A Shadow in the Dark. I recommend that you watch this one alone in the dark if possible, because you should. And half of you just went, Ashley, fuck that. Check out the YouTube horror short, A Shadow in the Dark. Possibly Google search the Japanese 2009 film Grotesque. Hint, hint. Heed my warning. I tried to scare you. Now you try to scare me. Rate and review Lullaby on Spotify, Apple, Google, and more. And follow on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Slasher, and Twitter at Lullaby the Fear Podcast. Sweet dreams. Lights out.